Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our friend James Dotson, I'm going to call him Jim in, as we talk, is a great writer, and for many reasons, a lot of people think of him as a golf writer. He's going to tell us whether or not that's the case or not. But he's won the Herbert Warren Award for the best golf book of the year twice.
Twice. Mm-hmm.
And maybe 10 or 12 books. He's the editor of, I know, three community-based magazines, O. Henry, Salt, and Pine Straw, and then a business with...
I sort of have caretakership of that.
Of that as well. But we came to talk about the new book,
yeah.
The Range Bucket List, The Golf Adventure of a Lifetime. Mm-hmm. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
Back to Chapel
Great
Hill.
Friend.
You kind of grew up between here and Greensboro.
And here, and you know, from Woody Durham to Dean Smith, I used to hang out with all them, and it's my kind of third home.
And we can remember your name because we have a crossroads named after
That's
you.
That's right. My family come from there. They've never let me forget that.
Do you ever go back to visit?
Oh, sure. I grew up off Buckhorn Road. My grandparents were, my grandfather, the Dodson family farm was right down, and Buckhorn Road leads into the poor side of Carrboro and the farm side. And my richest memories of life are going down from Greensboro to see my cousins Josie and Ida, two 90-year-old great aunties who lived in a cabin their father built for them when he came home from the Civil War. And they cut their heads off throwing chickens. They had matching outhouses. One had a moon on the door. The other had a star. And that's what I'm saying. This place is sacred ground to me. Orange County, Chatham County, Guilford County.
Well, we want to talk about all of that, but your book's coming out, and so mm-hmm. let's talk about your book, Range Bucket List.
Yep.
And the promotional material for the book says, many years ago, when James Dotson was 13 years old, he wrote himself a list titled Things to Do in Golf. It included the golfing aspirations of a young boy.
It did.
What does that have to do with your book?
Well, I had the luckiest golf writing life probably anybody's had. This is going to sound pretentious and self-centered, but I mean, it's the luckiest life I think anybody's had writing golf, probably since Henry Longhurst. And
You mentioned that, and you got to meet Henry Longhurst right before he died.
For a minute.
But we don't. No, I don't know who Henry Longhurst or who is he?
Well, Longhurst was the great English writer who loved golf. You know, they used to say the smaller the ball, the greater the pros. And there's an old saying about that. And that's true. I mean, Bernard Darwin was one of the great golf writers. And look, I came into golf as an escape from a world that I wasn't really happy in. And that was when I was 23 and finished school in this state, I got offered a job on the Sunday magazine of the Atlanta Constitution, which was the oldest Sunday magazine in the country. Margaret Mitchell had worked there, and I show up like a child put in the seat of an airplane, and I'd never written a magazine story. I grew up with the Daily News in Greensboro and writing stories for them, and I had a great year after college and won some awards, and that got me the job in Atlanta. And the next 8 years, I spent, 7.5 years, I spent writing about Klan rallies in Alabama and following corrupt politicians. I wrote about all the abscam characters and the you name a corrupt politician, I wrote about it. Three presidential campaigns, the missing and murdered in Atlanta, watching autopsies, hanging out with beat cops. I wrote about the gothic New South and Ted Turner. I was actually offered my first book contract when I was getting ready to leave Atlanta in 1983. Had just burned out at age 30, and called up my dad in Greensboro, and I said, I can't do this anymore. And he said, I'll pick you up. I called him from George H.W.'s office. I'd traveled with
him. Well, you'd been on that campaign.
Right.
On the vice presidential.
I had, yeah. And we got to be
Or was it on the presidential campaign that resulted in the vice presidential nomination?
Yes. And that was what he tried to beat Reagan in 1980, mm-hmm. and he didn't. But we became pretty good friends. We traveled all over together.
So were you working for the campaign, or were you covering the campaign?
No, I was writing about it. I was a journalist. I was writing about it. But in those days, and they do it now, you get on you're one of the boys in the bus. And I thought that would be my career, my life. It was very exciting. I was the youngest guy covering the on the national scene. Burned out at 30, though. I mean, it was too much death, too much mayhem, too much corruption.
Well, one senior political writer gave you advice to say.
Yeah, Jack Tremon. He turned to me one day.
We saw him on TV.
Yep, he died just last year, and he was a wonderful character. He was kind of like a Jabba the Hutt of the journalists. That every night these guys would get plowed. By the way, and so we're in Nashua, New Hampshire, and we're sitting at dinner. He turns to me and he says, "Kid, you seem to have a lot of pluck, but I tell you, there's one thing you got to do." And he says, "You got to get out of this profession before you become me." And he gives me this big brown tooth grin, and I was like, "Oh my God, he's right." But it was more than that. It was, Atlanta was a place where there was the new Sodom of the South. It was booming, and there was Ted
and
Turner.
A time when a Southern newspaper, even though the big Southern newspaper, would be able to have one of, instead of following the wire reports, be able to send its reporters.
They did,
to cover.
And we had the luxury. They thought we were prima donnas on the magazine because we would take 3 weeks, a month sometimes. It's like being on The New Yorker. It was great fun. And for me, it's really where I learned to write, and I worked for a wonderful editor named Lee Wauburn, who was best buddies with Pat Conroy, and I fell in with that crowd, although I was the kid in the group. I learned a lot. I had a lot of fun. It was a dark time. I realized years later, I coached mostly all-black baseball team, inner-city team, to 2 city championships, which it saved my life. And I really mean that, because my life was very fascinating. In terms of as a journalist, I got to cover all kind of crazy, awful things, never took a vacation, thought I was dying by age 30. Call my dad from Bush's office, say, I don't want to do it. The Washington Post, an editor had summoned me and said, "If you want this job, you really got to tell us and you got to fight for it." And I thought that was going to be my dream. And I quailed at the last minute. I said, I can't do this. I don't want to do this anymore. Called my dad from Bush's office. I said, and he wanted to hear how the job interview went. And I said, I just don't think I want to do this. And he said, "Change your flight to Raleigh. I'll pick you up." And I did. And he had my old Haig Ultra golf clubs in the back. And he said, "We're going to go down to Pinehurst and play." And we did. And, golf was the thing when I was a kid that was the great axis mundi for my father. I wrote a book called Final Rounds about taking him back to England and Scotland when he was dying of cancer in 1994 to play these golf courses.
You mentioned it as if it's just another book, but this Final Rounds is a book that you've got other life-defining events. But this book hit the heartstrings of many people, non-golfers.
Yeah, it was not a golf book. I mean, there's very little golf in it. There's a lot of rain and beer and talk and conversation.
Well, that's what golf is.
It
about.
Is. That's a good description of golf right there. The perfect description. I'll say Scottish
Scotland.
Beer, warm Scottish beer and rain, and cold English rain. And that book was that was the first time I ever really opened up about the murder of my girlfriend as college neared its end. She was murdered by a 15-year-old kid up in Hickory in a country club, of all things. And when I left North Carolina at 23, I really intended to sort of shake the dust off my feet, and my childhood was over.
And so you were going so where did you go?
So golf saved me when I was 30, because my dad and I go down to Pinehurst. I had not played golf. I lived in the home of Bobby Jones. I had not played golf in 7.5 years, if you can imagine. And this was a game that I just loved playing with friends and my dad. My hero was Arnold Palmer. When I wrote that list at 13, and I found this list not long ago, and he and Bobby Jones, the number one thing on my list of 11 things was I had to meet Arnold Palmer and Mr. Bobby Jones. And I never met Mr. Bobby Jones, but his daughter lived in Greensboro, so that was as close as I got. But I did meet Arnold, and that just to me proves the magic of America and being a kid who dreams of something.
So your dad took you down to Pinehurst, you played golf, and then so what?
I couldn't break 100. I mean, I was terrible, and we sat on the porch and had a beer on the Donald Ross porch, and he said to me, my father's nickname for him was Opti the Mystic, and he was such a wonderful, upbeat, generous man who had been through it took me another 25 years, 30 years to learn what tragedy happened to him in the war that made him such an upbeat, loving character. And he said to me, I called him a poet, an ad man with a poet's heart, and that really was him. He said to me, after I poured out my tale of woe, I just didn't want to do any more crime, I didn't want to write any more corrupt politicians. And he said, sport, maybe you're just writing about the wrong thing. Why don't you try something radical? why don't you write about something you love? And I said, well, I love golf, but I can't even play that anymore. And he said, you might be surprised. If you make a decision based on something you really care about and love, doors will open. If you use your good instincts and your love of the...
I tell you what, let's take a break.
Yep.
We'll come back, and I'm going to ask you, what was the door that opened? Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Jim Dotson. We're talking about his really wonderful new book, The Range Bucket List, The Golf Adventures of a Lifetime. And, Jim, when we left, you're leaving the South, leaving Atlanta, where you got an established writing, journalistic career, and you're going to explain to us how you got into golf writing. Where did you go to get into golf writing?
Vermont. I turned down another job. I waited too long to say yes to the Post. They gave it to somebody else. And then I had another chance to go to a magazine in Washington. And I just didn't want to be around Washington and the places I'd worked. So I headed off to Vermont. I ended up getting a job with Yankee Magazine, the old New England magazine. It was 80 years old. I was their first.
Is it like a Southern? Is this Yankee Magazine like Southern Living?
It had a great literary tradition. Everybody from John Updike to John Hershey John Kenneth Galbraith had written these stories for Yankee. It was a very folksy but also oddly profound magazine about New England
Why
life.
Would the
80
Yankee
years old.
Magazine want to hire a young Southern?
Well, it could be because the editor and I drank a bottle of whiskey together and we couldn't remember. Now, that's a true story. I went up to see Judd Hale, who was a wonderful editor of Yankee. Let me just say something. That magazine had 3 million readers in 1983. It was the largest and most successful regional magazine in the country. That's because Americans all trace their roots to New England one way or another. And my mother took it in Greensboro, a true Southerner. She had Yankee. I bet you right this minute in North Carolina, 5,000 people still have subscriptions to Yankee. They used to say Yankee subscribers don't die. They fail to subscribe. They just die. It was that loyal. It and the New Yorker had the highest loyalty rate of any magazine in American history. So I met the editor, and he said, I love the stuff you write. And I said, well, I don't want to write the really terrible things anymore, but I do love writing. And he said, well, we'd had 5 or 6 bourbons each. He loved the South, and he wanted to hear about the South. And he said, the South's a lot like the North, isn't it? And I said, actually, it is. I mean, it's very parochial in its love of itself, and the New Englanders are just a little more chaste in their conversation, and it's colder. So anyway, I went to work for Yankee, and I ended up working there for 10 years. I was their first senior writer in 80 years, and their only Southerner, so I had that distinction. And it changed my life. And when you look at O. Henry or Salt or Pine Straw—
These are the three magazines—
Arts, Culture magazines we have.
Greensboro, Wilmington. Southern Pines, and Wilmington.
And when you look at those magazines, what you see is Yankee, the influence of Yankee. They loved great writing. They loved writers. They loved great storytelling, and that's the tradition I wanted to continue. I just added, I wanted magazines that were beautiful, that sort of captured the great photography and artists of the areas of these towns and this state. And it's interesting, we have across the state probably about 130 readers, people who regularly read our magazine.
130,000.
I'm jumping way ahead in my brain. But that trip, moving to New England, I moved to a Green
River. All right, but we don't think of New England as being the center of the golf world.
No,
we think of Pinehurst being the
right.
center of the
so
golf
world.
Right,
so one day I'm at Yankee, and my father had said, he knew I loved golf, and I remember he said to me, and this is going to sound so corny, but tell the universe what you want to do. That was his code word for God. And he said, if you really want that and you believe it, the door will surprisingly, it'll open. I tell my kids, who are both in New York City and journalists and writers, I say, guys, you'll never see the door open unless you'll never see the person coming who changes your life.
All right, just to push you, Yankee Magazine is not a golf magazine.
No, it's a general. It's a general.
They don't even
magazine.
Write stories about golf.
Well, they never had, or they had the odd story about someone who had a golfing experience. So one day, this guy comes, the editor comes in, Tim Clark. He says, "Have you ever heard of Glen Aver, lady?" And I said, "Sure, she was the female Bobby Jones." I'm a student of golf, even if I'm not in that world. And I said, she won the Women's Open like 6 times, and I think she just died a few years ago. And he said, well, that's funny. Somebody forgot to tell her because she's about to play in her 69th straight Point Judith Invitational down in Narragansett. Why don't you go down and write a story, see if she'll let you caddy. So I snuck down there, and this is in the rain. This is probably my favorite chapter in the book. I show up on her door, I knock on the door, and I find this 83-year-old, intensely suntanned, stocky woman who's thumping her ceiling and says she has a raccoon in her attic and makes me come up the ladder and do that for a half hour. And she goes down, and then she puts me to work making soup, and she refuses to talk about golf. And I wore her down with my good Southern charm until the late afternoon. We sat out on her veranda, and she agreed to made her term. So you can't tell my son I was up the ladder, but I'll tell. Nobody's wanted to. She was forgotten. That story ran in Yankee. It was called.
So the story about a
lost,
important,
forgotten important person.
You sort of resurrected her, and she resurrected you.
She did. She gave me a new door. That's the door. The story ran in Yankee. It was called Making Soup with a Legend, and it was a funny story about convincing this wonderful woman who was convinced the golf world had forgotten her, and she was one of the great pioneers. And a guy from Bob Summers from the USGA called me up and said, gosh, I want to run that in the USGA's magazine. Then a guy from an editor from the largest magazine in Britain called me up and said, we want you to run it in this magazine. And then the editor of Golf Magazine, the biggest golf magazine in America, called me and said, would you like to go home into the South and write a story?
Well, I love this story. And as you know, I think this is but now the thing that makes me curious is you wrote this as a part of your staff writing responsibility for Yankee Magazine.
I did.
Salary.
Yeah.
And so that somebody comes along and wants to reprint it. You're an employee.
They paid me. That good magazines.
I know, but if you're on the staff of the magazine,
it was yours. By the way, put this out here right now. If you write for a magazine, even if you're a staff writer, you own the rights to those.
Even a staff member who's writing owns the.
There's
right.
a debate about this, but the Writers Guild in America has taken this to court several times, and the courts always come down on the side of the writer, because it's when. I think that what they ask is that you have to just say this first appeared.
All right,
somewhere.
So you owned it, and you then were able to sell it.
Yeah, I did.
For $100 or for?
I think they bought it for like $1,000, which was
the golf. You're making good money all
the
time.
What are you from the IRS?
The statute of limitations is run.
I was a poor writer, DG, living in New England.
I'm interested in the economics of this as well as the spiritual part of this story is what's got me going.
Yeah.
Because this is a happy, accident.
It is.
That
it is
you
totally.
Write an article about golf, and in the back of your mind or in the back of your heart, this is something you want to write about. You've chosen to write about New England.
That was a little bit like writing the magazines I do now. I mean, I wanted to write about the culture of New England, the old and the history. History always interested me. I didn't want to write the corrupt politicians and the death anymore, but I did want to write that. I was freelancing. I was hanging out with Andy Young for GQ and Esquire.
Down
and
in
like
Atlanta.
I wrote a lot of national pieces that way. So I could freelance. The deal with Yankee was you can freelance. And so they bought the piece. And then what really was cool was this editor from Golf calling me up saying, look, we think you would be a really great addition to our staff as a contributing editor.
Based on that one story.
Yes. So there's that door opening, and just as my dad said it would. And so I went on and I wrote a column. I wrote the tour for the first 5 years for Yankee and hated it.
I don't know what that means.
That means the PGA Tour.
So you just follow the tour.
You see it. No, I would go and write about players on the tour, and it was still a pretty good time. We were talking about the late '80s. There was, Curtis Strange.
But are you still doing the Yankee Magazine too?
Yeah, I did them both for a while, and then I finally, in 1991, Departures Magazine called me, the American Express Magazine, said, "Would you start a golf and outdoors column for us?" I did that for years, and that took me all over the world, and. I had such a lucky, fortunate life. I mean, I got to go all over the world and play golf, and I still wrote about politics a little bit. I still wrote whatever I wanted. And I became a contributing editor of Yankee after several years. So
that
I
means
worked
with what?
That means that they pay you a premium rate, and you're not on their retirement system or their health benefits.
You're a contract.
You're a contract participant. And I wasn't. So then at golf, the real moment that changed my life was 90, 93, I started writing a column called The Golf Life for Golf Magazine. And I said to George Pepper, who was the great editor there and wonderful guy, I said, George, I'm tired of writing about petulant, overpaid, rich tour players. I don't want to write about them anymore. I want to write about this 400-year-old game because it's full of eccentrics and people that family people and characters and oddballs and forgotten champions, Glen of Ayr. And I said, that's the stories I love to tell. And so he said, let's do it, and we'll call it. He said, what do you want to call it? I said, The Golf Life. Well, I wrote this. I don't think I ever wrote about an existing tour player ever again.
You wrote about other golf
players. I wrote about oddballs. And I once played with the only sand green champion of Montana on a mesa on a sand green golf course under the world's largest plastic, 75-foot plastic Holstein cow. That's it. And he beat me. He was wearing cowboy boots and spurs. That's the kind of oddball fun stories. Harvey Ward, I wrote about Harvey down here, the great Carolina amateur, and I wrote about his fall from grace and resurrection and rebirth.
Tell us the story about Harvey Ward and
Well, Carolina people know him.
Well, not so much anymore. You don't pick up you don't read that story.
Yeah.
It's a poignant and very sad story.
Yeah,
recovery story.
He won the 54, 55 U.S. Amateur and was a great amateur star at Carolina. He played against Arnold Palmer.
And what happened?
Well, he got to the summit. And
he's
then,
an amateur.
As an amateur, he won the U.S. Amateur back-to-back, was the first person to really do that, would have won the third one, which is the first person that was Tiger. And he got sanctioned for the USGA said that he was being paid by his employer, Eddie Lowry, who ran a Chrysler dealership in San Francisco, to go to the Masters. So he was hence, quote, taking money. And they sanctioned him and pushed him out of golf for a year, and he got his tail feathers up and decided he would start drinking, his game went to hell. He became an alcoholic. He got married four times. His fourth wife, Joanne, brought him back, made him come back to Pinehurst, where he'd won the North and South,
Did he become a teacher?
He cleaned up. He got sober. He became a great teacher, and he's probably the greatest player who never was. I mean, I asked Arnold one time when we were working on his memoirs. I said, you know, who did you fear most? And I thought he was going to say Jack Nicklaus. He said Harvey Ward.
Why didn't Harvey Ward just turn pro? I mean, that's what you would
do. He tried
today.
To, but once he'd come back, once he'd cleaned
because
there wasn't any money. I mean, Arnold Palmer, the first year he turned pro in 56, Harvey's the sanctioning of Harvey Ward sent at least 50 of the world's great golfers from the college ranks into the pros because they all had sponsors who paid for their motels or their travel or gave them free clubs or meals. And that was technically against the rules of the USGA. But it's funny, that's the kind of stuff I was writing about for golf. And I wrote a column about wanting to take my dad back to England and Scotland because I knew he'd had cancer, and I sent him some senior clubs. And it was a funny column about just thanking him for steering
about
me to golf.
Thinking about taking him.
Yeah, I said I said in the piece, it was a letter to him, and it was in the form of my column. And a publisher, Bantam from Bantam Books, called and said, that's a great book. Are you going to do it? And I said, I think I'm going to. And I convinced him to do it. And, you know, the funny thing, Final Rounds came out.
Column where your dad.
Mm-hmm. The book, Final
the
Rounds,
book,
came out.
Your mama
of that.
Mm-hmm. didn't want him to do it.
No, she didn't. Yeah,
but
no.
You took him.
She said to me, if something happens to your dad, you might well seek sanctuary in
but
Britain.
Let's take a break and then come back and let you tell us about this important book in your life. And Jim Dodson and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Jim Dodson. We're talking about golf and golf writing and other things. We're talking about golf, but we're really talking about human life, I guess,
stuff.
And how golf – and I don't want to get into what's your greatest book, but in some people's minds, your greatest book – is Final Rounds.
That's what you're going to say, Beautiful Madness, the garden book, which I think seven people bought. But.
Well, I love that book, and I love talking to you about the book, and we're not through with garden.
So you said Faithful Travelers.
Final Rounds.
Yeah. That book's very dear. As I said, when it came out in November of 20 years ago, of 1997, I thought if, you know, 200, if all my lint-eared, pink-eyed, redneck cousins in about six of these central counties bought a copy and my mother bought the 200 I knew she'd buy, that it would probably sell, you know, 300 or 400 copies. And it didn't even do that, I don't think. And then it got on the, I was in my barn in Maine and I got a phone call from this woman at Bantam and said, you know, your book is climbing on the New York Times list. Would you go on a book tour? And so I did. I went to New York and Washington. This was right before Christmas. And it's funny, I came to Greensboro, a big, big night in Greensboro, two nights in Greensboro at the Barnes & Noble, where I'll have this debut for Range Bucket List in a few weeks. And the next night I go to Charlotte, and there's an even bigger crowd, and I couldn't figure this out. I didn't know that many people in Charlotte. There are a couple of college roommates. And then there I see this little couple standing right behind the woman who knew my parents, and she's buying like six books and blah, blah, blah. And we're chatting away, and she steps away, and this little couple, they look like the farm family couple from American Gothic. And the woman says, "You ain't him, is you?" And I said, and the husband says, "No, I believe he's old. I thought he's older than this guy." And the woman says, "So you ain't him, is you?" And I went, "I could be. Who is him?" And she said, "You ain't James Dobson." It turns out James Dobson was in town to give a talk.
Oh, my golly, you were going to give him a sermon.
Yeah, and I said, "So, no, ma'am, I'm an Episcopalian, but there's only a D&B difference in our names. If you want to go get his book, I can sign it for him if you'd like." And she didn't think that was funny, and she walked out. And I'm telling you, that woman took every third person in that line with them. That explained the long line. Anyway, I went around the country. I got home to Maine two nights before Christmas Eve, and I went over to I'd promised this wonderful woman who'd run the Dartmouth bookstore forever that I would sign final rounds, and I pull up, and it's sleeting. Now, Mainers, I knew, were not going to come out for this book thing because, A, they're not stupid. They never go out in the season's first storm, and, B, they're cheap. They would never buy a new book. So there was indeed one car in front of the bookshop, and I'm getting out of the car, my truck, where my phone was attached, and the phone rings. And I hear this lady say, "Mr. Dodson, this is Winnie Palmer. I just am calling to say Arnold and I loved Final Rounds, and we really would like you to write Arnold's book for him and share the title page and the cover. Would you be interested?" Well, of course I was interested, except I didn't believe it was her.
It was a prank call, you thought.
My friends at Ham's. I was sure they'd been needling me. So I said, "Mrs. Palmer, that's great." I was going to needle them back, and I said, I think that's great. The truth is the Nicholases are coming for Christmas this year, and I'm getting ready to take them down to pick them up at the airport and take them to a Christmas party. And if it goes like it did a couple of years ago, Barbara and I are going to get completely skunked and make out like bandits. I'll have to call you back. And I hung up on her, and I went in and I signed my three books. And then I drove home in the blizzard and up our long hill. My wife and the kids had already gone up to Grandma's house for Christmas, just the dog and me. And I shove them away at the door. I go in the kitchen, the little red light's blinking on the answering machine. I push the button. I hear the same lady say, "Mr. Dodson, this really is Winnie Palmer. Arnold thought that was the funniest thing he's ever heard, and now he's, but he's gone to bed, and he said to tell you he wants you to do the book more than ever. So will you call us in the morning?" And that.
What did you think then? Because you're not going to jump at any opportunity,
right,
or did
right.
you say Arnold Palmer? My
well,
gosh,
I said that because
write.
I grew up in North Carolina.
Yeah,
I followed him around the GTO.
Yeah.
He was my hero. He was the first name.
He was
the first name on my. My things to do list I wrote when I was 12. Yeah. So suddenly I have a chance
now,
to.
Now, did they know you from your.
Yeah, they did. They knew my work from Golf Magazine, and I'd won a bunch of nice writing. That column won a ton of awards, or at least seven or eight over that 15 year period, because they were never about tour players. They were about eccentrics. And people thought that's the real game, by the way. Long story short, that I thought, you know, wow, I did have to pinch myself. I was sorry my dad was gone. My mother was very happy about that. So I spent 2 years with Arnold. Days after I said we agreed to do it, Winnie came down with a form of cancer, and he withdrew from the tour, and we spent really, I almost lived with him the next year and a half, 2 years, and we got the book out just before she died, and it's a very sweet part of the book. I tell all these stories in the books about Arnold that nobody's ever heard, and they'll all confirm what an amazing
guy. How's your book different from, or your and Arnold's book different from the other biographies that we read of?
It's funny you say that. When I was coming back, I was with him about 3.5 weeks before he died. I went up to see him, say goodbye in La Trobe last August. And on the way back, it was very emotional. That's in this book. That's how the book ends. And this book, by the way, is just really my love poem to the amazing people.
For anybody joining us late, we're talking around the new book, The Range Bucket List. As a part of that book, we have to talk about other books.
Right, because this is really a tale of how this door opened in one after the other, and I got to meet the most amazing people in the world, often through the game of golf. And Arnold, as I was coming home, weirdly enough, the phone rang. I was somewhere in between Cumberland, Maryland, and Greensboro, North Carolina. And the phone rang. I was coming down, I think, through Charlottesville, and the phone rang. And it was a young guy who was working on his PhD at Yale, and he had been told by the editor of Doubleday that the best autobiography collaboration was Arnold Palmer's A Golfer's Life with James Dodson. And he wondered if I would talk with him about how I did this book. And so I said to him, and this is in the Range Bucket List, I told him how I met with Arnold, and I said, look, listen, I can write your book from just the statistics alone or the clippings, but your fans deserve to know who you really are, and so I want to know all the terrible things that happened to you. I want to know the frustrations and the fears and the inadequacies you had. And he looked at his wife, and he gave me what I call the look, which is sort of a constipated eagle or a disapproving schoolmaster, and he said, "What do you think, babe?" And I said, "Your readers and your fans deserve no less. You're the most loved figure in the history of this game, and that's
but you got to tell something other than just
right. I want to know everything about you, and the other thing is, I don't want IMG to blue mark this book, to be able to edit anything out of this book. I want this to be between you and Winnie and me." And I thought that was the kiss of death. I thought I'd be shown the bum's rush to the door. He looked at Winnie and said, "What do you think, babe?" She said, "I think it sounds great." And I said, I said to him, "Listen, here's how I want to try to write this book." And this is what I told the guy from Yale is working on. And he was working on a big project about great literary collaborations. I said, I want this book to sound like you're sitting with them having a kettle one after a round of golf, and you're telling them that just these conversational stories about the dozen or 15 moments of your life that shaped who you became, and not all of them are happy. In fact, many of them aren't. And we put at least, here's the why you should have loved Arnold Palmer. He never once over that 2-year period said, "You can't use this," and told me amazing things, and many of which I used in the book. There's at least a dozen things nobody had ever read about Arnold, not all of them flattering. And as I said, they'll only draw people closer to you. They'll confirm that you're very...
This is how an author sells the subject on telling things that he doesn't really want to tell.
And I said, if it's handled the right way, you can tell them anything because it'll only make you feel as mortal as they are.
You're not walking around
It's honest.
Anymore.
Right. It's honest. You're not...
I hate to take a break right now.
Oh, go.
We're in the middle.
go.
Join us late. This is DG Martin. I'm visiting with Jim Dodson. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to His Talk. And this is DG Martin. My guest is Jim Dodson. Jim is well known for many reasons. Right now, we're talking about his golf writing experience, in particular, his new book, Range Bucket List. He'll be appearing all over soon and then later to talk about the book. And if you want to talk about it, I bet you he'll come to your golf club to talk about it as well. But maybe trying to pick out which is the most popular or most important book, it might be the book that you wrote about your dad and your travels. Mm-hmm. It also might be the book you wrote with Arnold Palmer that we were talking about. Yeah. And, you know, golfing fans, like basketball fans, Arnold Palmer sort of the Dean Smith of golf in many ways. You had the opportunity to write his book. I mean, and how did you persuade him? You had a deal that we're going to talk about, and I'm going to find out the things that shape your life, the disappointments as well as the triumphs. And how did you persuade him to talk about, to tell you, and to give up these secrets that he had?
Well, quite honestly, you remember I'd had almost a 20-year 25-year career writing, interviewing mob bosses and Klansmen and hanging out with.
So this was easy.
Yeah, Arnold Palmer's a piece of cake. I mean, and he's a nice guy. And he understood Winnie. The nicest thing Winnie said to me near one evening, we're sitting at the I really, really did live with him. I mean, I traveled everywhere with Arnold. And we really had a great chemistry. He loved, I could get him to laugh. We played golf matches against other well-known people just for fun at La Trobe. We neither one wear socks. We just had a, just put
so
on.
So how are you funding your life at this point?
Well, they give you an advance, and so I'm also the publishing house. Valentine.
So you and Arnold Palmer had the deal, and then
the publishing house had the deal. They asked me to do it, and they said, but Arnold would like to talk to you. He thinks you're the choice to do
so
it.
So you're but are you all the co-authors? Or
yeah,
you
we're
the
co-authors.
So he had to sign the contract as well.
Yeah, he did.
He got a little advance.
He got a very nice advance, and I got paid very well, and we became great friends. And I saw him every other year for his birthday, and Winnie and Wendy and I and Arnold, we'd go out to the desert and see him, and I watched him get old, and he watched me get older, and we became great friends. And that's what this special about this book. These are the people over that 35 or 40-year history period that I never, that career I never saw happening that saved my life. This is what that book's about. It's about these funny people like Bill Campbell and John Updike.
Also play golf. You also got to know through your golfing experience the President of the United States.
I did. I know. I got
our
a couple
presidents
of them.
Of
yeah.
The United States, but the current President of the United States.
No, well, you're talking about our. Yeah, I went to see over to Trump National. That's a chapter in the book. And he's a character. He's kind of exactly what he seems, and it's a funny chapter because it was a very funny thing what he said to me, and I'll leave that hanging for another day.
Well, will you tell us what Arnold Palmer said when you reported to him that our current president said he was like this?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was with Trump, he said when one of my colleagues at the table said, Jim's on his way up to see Arnold Palmer, Trump said, oh, Arnold and I are like this, and he showed me crossed arms and crossed fingers. And when I told Arnold that the next night at the dinner, he crossed his hands at his throat and said, no, Shakespeare, it's more like this, and he busted out laughing. Look, golf is a game that is very revealing. It's a game that they say you want to – it not only reveals characters, plural, meaning people that play it or eccentrics, but it reveals character or the lack of it. It's a game of integrity. It's a game of history and tradition. There's almost no older game that we play. Golf is a 450-year-old game. It's basically the fundamental game that started on the windblown dunes of Scotland, where with a feather and a gull and a hole created by the cattle on the Link land that held the town to the water. So it's a game that's the game I love. I don't really. I'll watch the Masters or I love watching the British Open. It's the closest to the real game. But that's the game that 90% of the people who love the game of golf play.
Well, you played St. Andrews number two at Pinehurst. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But if you had to choose this afternoon where you would play golf, where would you go?
Well, I should say Mid Pines down in Southern Pines, because that was the first 18-hole championship course I ever got to play. And I got thrown off of my dad's course in Greensboro and taken down there.
Good story in your book.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I'd have to say Green Valley Golf Club, which doesn't exist anymore. If you drive up Green Valley Drive, where the Proximity Hotel is in Greensboro from Friendly Center, when you pass that hotel, you're in the middle of the 10th fairway of that old club where I grew up, where I hit my first balls, where the pro threw me off, and where I played a lot of golf with my dad, and it was where I learned the game.
Well, there's a nine-hole course in Greensboro, and I thought that's what you were going to tell me.
Well, I only played that, and it's at the end of the book. I'd never played it. I used to pass it with my dad. It's Gillespie, and I used to pass it. It's kind of in the downtrodden part of town, and my father would say to me, was once a great golf course. I learned to play golf there. And I said, are you serious? Because it was kind of a muni, and it was kind of down at the heel. And it turned out it was really built by one of the great designers of the Golden Age.
It's a great course. But then I thought you were going to – you call these goat farm
Yeah, Glorious Goat Farms. They're all over North Carolina. They
like
cost $10 to play. And you know, that's the soul of the game. As I wrote about that in Scotthurst. How great is that name? The Scotthurst Golf Club down in Lumber Bridge. And I love playing alone. I love going up to one of these old country golf courses where it's $10 and you meet some guy on the tee or his wife and you play, and you know, that's the soul of the game.
Coming into these sanitary
absolutely
multi-million dollar golf
right.
Locker rooms.
Yeah, exactly.
And
Taj Mahals, I call them.
Yeah. That's not your...
No, it's not.
Jim Dotson, thank you.
Oh, my
pleasure.
This
has just been great fun to talk to you about your book, and even more fun than reading it, which is a lot of fun.
Well, you're
thanks
the best,
for sharing
DG.
It with us.
Thank
and
you.
And look forward to talking to you about it again sometime soon. And reminiscing about your time in Chapel Hill.
Oh, absolutely.
My guest has been Jim Dotson. He's telling us about his new book, The Range Bucket List. Thanks for listening. I'll be back here before you know it.